Listen to me. We can give it a try. I'll look you straight in the eye and pull you to me. What I'm gonna do next, I'll even tie it to your imagination. Do you hear me? If you don't understand, I'll take a hold of your hand and pull you near me. What I'm gonna do next, I'll even tie it to your imagination.
Hello and welcome to The Sector, the radio show podcast discussing the world of nonprofits, social justice, and activism. With me, your host, Ethan Clow, and we are broadcasting right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, that's on your radio dial, as well as streaming online at citr.ca, and of course via podcast, whenever and wherever as technology permits. Well, welcome to the show, everybody. I hope you're having a fantastic Friday morning. It is beautiful out, as beautiful as it gets in the middle of January. And of course, this is our second episode of the new year, so hurrah, it is the new year. We have a great show today. I'm very pleased with our guest today, Mr. Gareth Kirkby, who of course wrote a thesis statement regarding the charitable sector, the CRA, the Harper government, and the charitable chill that we've been discussing on this show for the past couple of months. And as we are talking about today's episode of The Sector and future episodes coming up, I wanted to give you all a bit of a heads up on a few things that we have coming up down the pipeline here on the show. Next week, we hope to have with us Mr. Noah Ferguson. Noah, of course, is a friend of myself and Gareth. He joined us for a special event put on by NetSquared Vancouver, and we're going to talk with Noah a little bit about the activism side of the nonprofit world, why it's important for charities to make their voices heard and be players in the political arena. So we'll get Noah's perspective on that. If you have any questions or thoughts that you want to send to us ahead of time, you're welcome to. You can tweet them at The Sector Podcast or at Ethan Clow on Twitter. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/sectorpodcast, and of course, emailing us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. And what will be the next big topic on the show, you might ask? Well, to answer that question, let's consult the dice. And by rolling dice, that does not mean I, in fact, worship the devil. But we are going to investigate the sociological phenomenon that made people think that if you did roll dice, perhaps playing D&D, you did worship the devil. Yes, in 2 weeks' time, we're going to look at the moral panic that consumed America in the 70s and 80s, and focus on everything including tabletop RPG gaming, as well as rock music, drug culture, the general sort of 70s and 80s vibe, and we're just going to take a look at it from a sociological point of view, figure out what was going through their heads, what were they thinking, but also, what effect did this have on society? How did it change our way of looking at the outsider, nerd culture, underground cultures, and all that kind of stuff? So it should be very fascinating. I look forward to diving into that with you. So there is lots of great content coming down on The Sector this month and next. So I hope you'll stay tuned and take a listen. In the meantime, let's take a quick commercial break here on the show. We'll return after this with our interview with Gareth Kirkby. So stay tuned, folks. More is coming up next on The Sector.
Whoever said money can't buy you friends obviously wasn't a member at CITR. When you become a member, you get the Friends of CITR card with incredible discounts in the downtown area at
The Baker and the Chef, Bang On T-shirts, Beat Street Records, Dunlevy Snack Bar, The Fall Tattooing, Fortune Sound Club, Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinematheque, Perch, The Portside Pub, Save On Meats, and Vinyl Records.
To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to citr.ca.
I imagined what it would be like to be a wizard, and then I pretended and acted in that way on the day.
Studies show that 9 out of 10 wizards prefer CITR 101.9 FM.
If we were to draw a graph of my process, of my method, something like this, Sir Ian, Sir Ian, Sir Ian, action. Wizard, you shall not pass! Cut! Sit in.
Joining us now on The Sector is Gareth Kirkby. Gareth is the author of a thesis, Uncharitable Chill, a critical exploration of how changes in federal policy and political climate are affecting advocacy-oriented charities. Gareth, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for inviting me, Ethan.
So let's start at the beginning. How did you get involved in this story, and what was its genesis?
Its genesis was back in 2012. I can remember hearing and seeing the rhetoric that was coming from some federal cabinet ministers, in which they seemed to suggest that some of our charities were criminal organizations, were money launderers, were terrorists, and then they were added to the list of potential terrorist threats in Canada, specifically environmental organizations were. And that kind of, I put that in the back of my head, and when I was looking for a subject for my recent master's thesis at Royal Roads, it came back to me that I wondered what has been the effect on charities of this rhetoric and the 2012 budget, which gave a lot of money to Canada Revenue Agency, and the budget told CRA to audit charities with particular attention to what is called political activities, which are allowable activities. But they do sound rather unallowable.
And you mentioned the rhetoric that you heard, environmental charities being called terrorist organizations, et cetera. This was coming from people who held office, officials in the Harper government. This wasn't simply, you know, an angry editorial in the National Post. This was coming from pretty serious sources.
That's right, Ethan. Actually, the kickoff to that was Joe Oliver writing a letter in January 2012 that was reprinted in the Globe and Mail and a lot of other places, in which he suggested that these were radical organizations that were out to destroy the economy and hurting average working people. And those thoughts were echoed by incoming Environment Minister Peter Kent and by Finance Minister Jim Flaherty, and then re-echoed again by Prime Minister Harper and strongly through the Sun media chain, and particularly Mr. Levant.
Mm-hmm. And when you were researching this topic, how difficult was it to find information?
Well, you know, there's two points to that. One is that I found significant information about the history in Canada of charities, of particularly of volunteer organizations, and some literature around that. There are academics working in the area of how to have a strong what's often called the third sector. That helps deal with the issues that our economic system creates or doesn't sufficiently address, nor government. So there was a lot of academic work I could draw on, although less of it specifically aimed at charities that advocate on issues of public policy. But in terms of, I wanted to interview charity leaders and other experts, and it was quite difficult to find people who would sit down and talk with me. In the end, only several of them would talk on the record. All the rest wanted to be anonymous themselves, and that my data anonymized their organization as well. And under those conditions, protecting those identities, they opened up quite a lot to me.
And, you know, based on your research and the response that you got when people are saying we want to be anonymous and we want you to make sure that our organization isn't mentioned, what did you find was at stake here? What was the big mystery and the big risk that these charities were facing?
Some of them felt that the government was out to get them, more or less, and that that's what some labeled the demonizing, that they'd been demonized by the government with the rhetoric, and now the government was using the tax man to try to hurt them and to cause reputational damage. And of course, many charities the purpose of having the ability, being a registered charity and being able to write receipts for donors is that those donors get a tax deduction, and so it having charitable status draws in the money they need to pursue their visions and their missions. And so there was this sense that they've taken a few hits in public already, and they weren't quite sure how best to respond, and that there was significant risk in talking to a master's student working on a thesis.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned CHILL, the charity CHILL that's been going on. How have you seen this reflected in the sector?
Yeah, I wasn't the first person to find a charity chill, actually, and to find a politicization of Canada Revenue Agency by the federal government. A couple of other accomplished and well-cited lifetime researchers at universities had already pointed that out, that something seemed to be happening starting in 2006, and that it had after the 2012 budget that the CRA had been successfully politicized by the government.
And you and I have talked about this before. We participated in the NetSquared Vancouver event. It was a great discussion about it. We had a lot of great input from the charity sector. You talked about, at that event, the narrowing of society's public conversation about charitable activities. Could you elaborate on that a bit?
Yeah, I'd like to pull back a little all the way to 2006 and go forward from that if I can, Ethan.
Please, yeah.
When the new government came in 2006, they started defunding organizations that had different ideas about certain topics than themselves. For instance, there was a massive pullback on funding to women's groups, particularly child care groups, women's health groups, literacy groups, gay and lesbian organizations and events. International development took big hits that continued on through 2006, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 budget in 2000. And during that period of time, organizations that many of them charities, not all of them, some of them other kinds of members of social movements, like nonprofits and so on, they found that they were asked less and less to come and talk to ministers, to talk to deputy ministers and people in the government as they were forming policies. So they were losing their funding. They were experiencing the door closed to them. They weren't getting the invites when they approached. They weren't invited in. And then in 2011, we had an election, and a majority government came in, and it now had the seats it needed to be able to implement policies, I suppose, that it wanted to implement, and proceeded to do so, and to be able to choose its priorities in different ministries and so on. But in they also, as their economic policy, they chose a major ramp up of natural resources, and particularly around the oil sands and exporting to foreign markets the oil out of the oil sands and some natural gas, and building pipelines, tankers, rail cars, the rest of that. And at the same time, they had different priorities around international development and so on. And these things started to show. But at that time, if you cast back your mind back to 2012, a lot of there was a lot in the media about climate change, and there were international treaties under debate, and so on and so forth. And the current government was losing that debate. Public opinion was really strongly on the side of addressing climate change, and not on the side of massive new development of carbon-based energy, which became the government's policy. So the government needed to push back. This is what I heard over and over again, and it makes sense when you look at the theory of Gramsci and others. The government pushed back by essentially trying to change the topic of conversation to how some organizations, some charities, particularly environmental charities, were we're hurting the country, about international foundations that were helping fund our charities, international development charities and other charities. And they turned the conversation around with this aggressive rhetoric that then, of course, led to the CRA audits.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, talking a lot about like the environmental and the international development charities, what are some other areas that you've seen this effect happen? I mean, I think a famous example is the whole InSight situation here in Vancouver, the safe injection site. There's been a lot of harm reduction drug policies and healthcare ideas that have been kind of floundering across the country that I think also seem to be sort of feeling this pinch.
Well, you know, Ethan, that's a good point because, you know, my focus has been on the issue of charities and social movements in my thesis. But yes, you know, I spoke earlier about, you know, how some of the women's health voices were muffled and literacy voices and gay and lesbian voices. And you know, it went into other areas too. Others have written quite extensively about, there's a book out there called Harper's War on Science by Chris Turner, that's a very interesting read. And definitely the government has laid off 2,000 scientists, it closed down many offices, it eliminated whole fisheries libraries, it's reduced the budget for our national archives and libraries, and you know, essentially voices that may have spoken about different policy options than those favored by this current government, those voices have been slowly, bit by bit, muffled and reduced, so that the dominant voice now is the voice of the priorities of this government, and almost every facet. The government's voice is louder than the voices of other alternatives in society, and that is unusual, you know, because there's always been opposition to government policies and stuff, and different governments, whatever party they are, provincial or federal level, have all had their opposed government policies. And sometimes the government, you know, has pushed back a little bit. But there's something new happening here, Ethan, and that is that this government is treating these charities, these civil society organizations, they're treating them as enemies of the state by labeling them as potential terrorists. And they're treating them as enemies of the government. And who is the government? The government is all the MPs we elect and not just the cabinet. They're treating them as un-Canadian. They're using rhetoric that others them, that suggests they're un-Canadian. And this is a step further than our traditional history. We've had some of that in wartime. We've had some of that during the Red Scare years when, you know, we had the fruit machine and gays and lesbians were fired, 400 and some of them from the federal government and so on. But this is a period where there's a government here that is unprecedented in its approach to charities. That, you know, we all donate to charities. We've all got our favorites, and some of our favorite charities are being treated by our government that we've elected as if they were enemies of their party, of their politics, of their policies rather, and of the country itself.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting because when your thesis came out, it made a big splash. I mean, the National Post, Globe and Mail, a lot of people were shocked and surprised by what you found. And a lot of people in the charity sector, and I can relate to this. I mean, when I was at my position a few months ago, it was a lot of people were talking about it. It was big news around the water cooler, as they say. And it really took off. I mean, what was your perspective on that part of the whole thing?
Well, I think part of it was that, you know, I was far from the only person in the country who was wondering how charities were reacting to the rhetoric and the CRA audits. But you know, I know that that reporters were not getting on the record or off the record comments from the charity leaders because they were keeping their heads down on the whole. And so things were happening with CRA. Things were happening behind the scenes, and it wasn't coming out. And so when I was done my thesis and I sifted through my data and come to my conclusions, my findings, there was an interest by first of all with the media, and I got that out there and it got picked up and they really ran with it. Because it found what I think a lot of people had feared. A lot of readers out there, it's their charities. These are the charities that we donate to that are experiencing this. And I think it kind of hits home, you know. We hear this rhetoric about charities, you know, and we begin to wonder, well, are some of them terrorists? And are they, you know, are they enemies of the country? Are they undermining our country to help the American oil industry, which was suggested by Joe Oliver's letter? And, of course, it's interesting because most of the oil companies are American-owned and internationally owned. But people wondered, and this hit home for a lot of Canadians, and built on top of the fact that the previous year there'd been a lot of coverage about how the scientists were being silenced, that they had to go and get permission from their bosses in the Prime Minister's office before talking to media, and were often told they couldn't, and they were being laid off, and so on, what happened to the women's movement in this country. In losing major funding at a time when a lot of projects were being discussed, and then, you know, stuff about First Nations government being confrontational with First Nations and stuff. And I think it's been kind of building up with Canadians this sense that this government is not behaving the same way as other governments to other players in society, because, you know, we've got businesses in society and then we've got government in society, but there's a third sector there that's our all the various kinds of charities and nonprofits and our unions and it's all those groups that do good in society. It's the church groups. Half the charities in the country are churches and other religious organizations, and that whole sector is being treated in a really curious and concerning way. So I think that really got people's attention. Yeah, Ethan.
And we're chatting with Gareth Kirkby on his thesis, Uncharitable Chill, here on The Sector on CITR. Gareth, I mean, you talked a bit about the charity leaders. What about the leadership within the charitable sector, Imagine Canada, and elsewhere? I mean, no, I don't want you to name any names that don't need to be named, but what was the response from sort of the leadership portion of the sector?
Yeah, that's interesting, because my interviews, you know, with both the charity leaders, and I talked to charity leaders in five sectors of charities in five provinces, and I also talked to five charity experts out there, the professors and others at important organizations. And the people I talked to, a lot of them, you know, they were working within their own sectoral umbrellas to address some of the challenges they're facing with this government and funding and so on. And others were looking at other umbrellas. And there's a group called Imagine Canada that's sort of the umbrella of the charities in Canada. It's the lobby group, if you will. It's a charity itself. And it provides resources for charities. It does really important work out there, and a lot of them had hoped that Imagine Canada would be stepping up with all this rhetoric, that the Imagine Canada would be stepping up with a publicity campaign, maybe advertising on TV, advertising in the papers, you know, that sort of set the record straight about the important role that charities play in Canadian society. How, you know, it helps feed the hungry. It helps house the homeless. It It works to pick up the people who fall through the cracks. It also speaks of policies that are in our interests, right? And for instance, our acid rain was solved largely because of political activities by Canadian charities, perfectly legal political activities by Canadian charities. And our smoking laws come from charities, cancer charities speaking up, and other health charities speaking up. And seatbelt laws come from charities convincing government and convincing the public who put pressure on the government to bring in seatbelt laws. And so this is how it works, right? The charities are experts in their area. A charity that deals with feeding the hungry people, they have some ideas about the kind of policies that we ought to have, as well as doing practical hands-on things. And we need to hear from them in our society. And they need to be at the table, but they're not being invited in the way that they used to be.
You know, it's ironic that we're doing the interview today, as we learned earlier that the organization Dying with Dignity is losing its charitable status for being too political. And, I mean, this seems like, on one hand, a very heavy-handed way to deal with this. The excuse given by the CRA is that it was a mistake, they never should have had it in the first place. But it also seems a little bit... You would think that the CRA would have a bit more leeway in these sort of matters, that they would give a few warnings ahead of time. You're being too political, you know, bring it down a little bit before they say, no, you're out.
Mm-hmm.
Are you surprised by that?
I'm not really surprised, and I hear what you're saying about, you know, why can't CRA work with a charity to bring it into compliance and find a way to work with it? But the CRA, it's curious that this is another charity that has an approach to dying that's maybe different than the approach of the current federal government. And then a couple of weeks ago, we heard from a development charity. In Quebec, called Alternatives, that has also been told that it should never have been given charitable status and been given a list of things it needs to do to maintain it that it finds it's unable to do. And in both those cases, they were told that they should never have charitable status to begin with, and some of them have had it for decades, and some of them. They're not the only charities getting this kind of a response. And it's curious that now charities that have been around for 30, 40 years and have gone through multiple audits over those years and have passed them, and maybe they were asked to make one little change and they did, and the next one they did fine or whatever, that those charities all of a sudden in this period, they're being found to not be within the limits and that they shouldn't have had their status all along, and so, you know, what is going on there? I would say too, though, that that CRA is partly boxed in by the definitions that we have of what the allowable purposes for Canadian charities are. You know, we've got four purposes for charities in Canada, and whereas the United Kingdom, which used to have the same as us. The United Kingdom now has 13 purposes because they amended their charity legislation. Our charity legislation dates from 1891, from a case in the House of Lords in Britain, and the wording is almost identical to 1891. And those 1891 were slight changes from wording during Queen Elizabeth I's era. So we've got laws that were proclaimed by Queen Elizabeth I and modified under Queen Victoria that haven't had substantial updating since. And so, you know, for instance, the UK now, you can have a charitable purpose of trying to attain expand human rights, but that's not a charitable purpose in Canada. And yet, you know, when I talk to people and I say, do you know that you're not allowed, that in Canada, you know, it's having a purpose of expanding human rights is not a charitable purpose. It's not allowed. You can't get a charity if that's what you're doing. You can't get approval. people are floored because it's just it's a no-brainer that we should be able to donate and get a tax deduction for a charity that's working advancing human rights in our country, advancing equality and rights in our country. You're allowed to feed the hungry, but you're not allowed to have a major portion of your resources, any more than 10, go to advocating for changes in government policies to feed the hungry. Truly bizarre. Now, Britain has expanded these, right? And Australia and New Zealand have made similar changes as well. It's absolutely bizarre. And I think that CRA is partly trapped by this. But it's still extraordinary that there's not a way to, you know, grandfather charities that received approval previously. Can they not be grandfathered?
Well, it's an interesting question. I know from my personal experience, when I was working with the Center for Inquiry, we were a secular-minded charity, and we found it absolutely crazy difficult to get our charitable status. We had to apply under educational categories, and we were trying to offer like secular humanist philosophy and ethics, and yet we couldn't get under the religious category because, well, we're not. And so we had to kind of change the whole face of how we organized ourselves. And again, you look at what the UK has done, some really interesting changes to their perspective on charitable giving. And I mean, you mentioned the poverty issue. I believe it was it UNICEF? Or correction, that was Oxfam, not UNICEF. They had to change the wording of relieving poverty because that wasn't charitable or...
It wasn't quite that, but it was that they were changing as part of another process of re-registering for with Industry Canada. They wanted to change some of their purposes and objects and so on. And one would expect that would be a routine thing for an organization. They went through quite a scene with Canada Revenue Agency, and were told yes that they could only be working to alleviate hunger by putting food directly in people's bellies. So you couldn't work on the policy. All you could do was give somebody some food, as a purpose. Now, there's some room in there for advocating for policy because you're allowed, all charities are allowed, at least 10% of their resources can go to political activities. Now, you know, that phrase, political activities, and, you know, the whole thing about auditing them for that that came in the 2010 budget makes it sound like it's a bad thing, but it's perfectly legal. And all that political activities is basically when, you know, when that charity asks you, if you want that seatbelt law, would you please phone your local MLA? That is political activity. It's not about people coming forward and saying, you know, vote Liberal. That is partisan activity and completely verboten. And charities, well, frankly, they don't do that. Or very, 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 very few do. But most charities do some political activities, even some of them, though, that are not aware of it. But they're allowed to do it up to 10% of their resources, 10% of their money spent on it, 10% of their time spent on it, et cetera. And very few of them come anywhere near that from what I could gather in my data. And yet they're being audited for something that they're already only doing 1 or 2 or 3% on. So why are they being audited to do that? Well, what I found in my thesis is that they're being audited to do that to divert them, right? So what it's doing is that they're afraid. They're preparing for an audit or going through an audit, and they don't want to lose their charitable status. So now they get a little bit paranoid about their communications. And I found over 30 ways in which charities were changing their communication about their mission. That's them talking to us about their mission activities. They're talking to their members, talking to the public, talking to politicians about their... All of that is totally allowable. And so the fear of the audit has caused them to change their communications, and it's distracted them. The time that they're putting into all this paranoia and putting into learning this new CRA rules that changed in 2012 and making sure all the staff are absolutely perfectly tracking each and every kind of activity so that they can work out percentages and everything, all that time and energy and nervousness is all a diversion from working on their missions. And that is what this is all about, is that the current government, in essentially going after certain sectors of charity, particularly the environmental charities working on energy issues and pipeline and oil sands, in going after them with the threat of audits, they're diverting them, but they're diverting other charities as well. You know, the what do they call it in war when you end up dropping the bomb on people that you didn't want to hurt? Collateral damage. There's collateral damage throughout the entire charity sector happening because all charities are now looking at their communications and are wasting their time working on paperwork instead of their missions. So that's what's behind it all, is this attempt to muffle them in their communication, make them less effective, and they're particularly thinking here of the energy-related environmental charities and other, you know, think tanks and so on that are working on energy issues, and to distract them from carrying out their mission tasks and activities.
Let's talk about a charity that's not being audited. There's one that you know, the Fraser Institute. They do a lot of political activity, and it's raised the question of, you know, how are they able to get away with so much, and yet, you know, the Amnesty Internationals of the world, they're being under a microscope compared. What is your take on that?
I'm not an expert on the activities of the Fraser Institute, frankly. The Fraser Institute does claim, however, that it doesn't do any political activities, and that their activities are all charitable activities. That's their claim. It's my understanding that they went through a financial audit recently, but you know, I don't know that to be true as a fact. So it's conjecture, but it's what's going around in Vancouver amongst other charities. This belief that the Fraser Institute did go through an audit recently, but not the kind of audit that the government has sent CRA after charities to do, Whereas, for instance, there's a couple of other more a Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, a one of Canada's very, very few. I think there's three or four, depending how you define it, centre left, liberal left leaning charity think tanks that out there, compared to dozens of right leaning think tanks out there. Particularly, like there's already like eight economic think tanks in the Fraser model, more or less. Not all of them are charities; some of them are just nonprofits. But you know, it's interesting that Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, which comes up with policy ideas that are often significantly different, but not always significantly different from those of the current government, they've gone through an audit and they've spoken publicly about that experience.
Let's talk about evidence for a moment. We've discussed in the past that it's unlikely we'll ever find, you know, a smoking gun memo signed by Stephen Harper saying, do this to the charity sector. But what sorts of evidence did you find and can you expect to find regarding this kind of crackdown on the charity sector?
Yeah, you know, a smoking gun is going to be kind of hard, although, you know, the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives did find some interesting internal emails that sort of maybe you can't see the smoke on the gun, but you can smell that a bullet's been shot. But you know, what would a smoking gun be on this, right? To say that, you know, that the current federal government has directly told CRA, go and get the environmental and international development and union funded charities. You know, what would it take? It would take a memo from that came to light of a cabinet minister that basically pointed in that, or showed that a cabinet minister had a very strong interest in whether or not it was taking place on a given charity. You know, if that came up, or a deputy minister sending an email or a memo or a text to somebody below saying, you know, can you tell me whether such and such a charity has had an audit recently? That I think that's what people would consider a smoking gun. But whether somebody's written something like that, you know, whether they've done it is not provable, and whether without something like that. But you know what I found was something that I think is much more, you know, realistic, and that is, you know, even if there's not a smoking gun, even if a cabinet minister did not whisper in the ear of a deputy minister who whispered in the ear of somebody else, and then got and certain sectors got targeted, you've still got this thing where the government created a funnel. They created the conditions that would move CRA toward auditing certain sectors. And they did that by, you know, first of all, they had a member of a communications professional within Minister Jason Kenney's office left and started a private nonprofit organization called Ethical Oil, which started filing complaints about certain charities, particularly environmental charities and others that were working on oil issues. And then the government, then had added environmentalists to the terrorist list, and then the government had a budget in which it made money available to CRA while it was cutting money for others, and said, use this money to look at political activities of charities. And then, you know, CRA employees would follow that, and they'd look in the files and they'd say, okay, which charities are declaring higher political activities right now? You know, let's go and check those out. And they'd open up and they'd find that, oh, well, under this current government, you know, every government it would vary which particular charities were doing more political activity than others, you know, like, you know, call your MP about such and such. I guess during this period, maybe there's some environmental charities and international development charities would have slightly higher political activities than others. Remember, they're allowed up to 10% of their resources. And then you start looking in there, and they would find that, oh wow, look at that! Not only are they, you know, are they around 5 or 6% in a political activity that they're declaring, when others are around 0 or 1 or 2. But there's also these complaints in there from Ethical Oil and from other places. So you know, it would be a natural place to start for a CRA to audit those particular charities in the first couple of waves. And, you know, they're doing 60 of these political activity charities, and they've done about 52 or so, 52, 54 of them so far. And some would stand out. So by giving that direction and having the complaints on file at CRA, it pushes CRA toward auditing certain charities which, oh wow, by coincidence happen to be the charities that have different ideas about the best policies for the country, and particularly charities that have a different economic priority than that the government has adopted, natural resources, and particularly domestically, oil. And oil sands, and in terms of foreign businesses, of course, be mining companies.
Well, Gareth, maybe we should end on a happy note. So mm-hmm. I'd like to ask you a question that I ask most of our guests here on the sector, and that is for a pitch of the week. So the charity sector is suffering. They need our help. If you had the ear of a billionaire and they said, Gareth, what should I donate to? What would you direct them to donate to?
You know, that's a really hard one for me, because, you know, I've done this study with with them, but I can tell you that right now the environmental charities and the international development charities and the left-wing think tanks have taken particularly hard hit. So I would suggest that perhaps if those are charities that have particular interest for you, my thesis found that those charities that the ones that are going through the hard times are environmental charities that are working in some way on energy issues and pipelines and habitat where the pipelines will go and the shipping. International development agencies that doing really important work in the developing world, and charities that are funded partially by unions. So they've had all this rhetoric at them now. But there's also collateral damage to other charities. So I'd say instead of saying a specific charity, I'd say those three sectors would be a great pick.
Excellent. Well, our listeners can take that as a start and look into those charities. I'm sure that they would love your support. So finally, Gareth, where can our listeners turn to get more information about this charitable chill that's been going on, get your thesis and
sure.
Learn more. Yeah.
Two things. You can I have a blog I have a website which has a blog on it, and it's also got my thesis there in PDF form as well as electronic. So that's garethkirkby.ca, all one word, GarethKirkby.ca, GarethKirkby.ca. So my thesis is there if you want to delve in a little deeper. I think you might find it interesting. And the other one is there's actually the charitable sector itself has put together or I should say not just the charitable sector, but civil society organizations and movements have put together a website that details many of the different kinds of muffling and silencing and layoffs and firings and defundings and so on that's gone on since 2006. And it's called Voices Voix. So Voices, V-O-I-C-E-S hyphen Voix, V-O-I-X. I think it's .ca. But it might be .org, but Voices Voix website, and they're documenting stuff as it comes along. I found that as part of my background research, and I think people find that a really interesting read.
Excellent. Well, Gareth, thank you so much for joining us on The Sector. It's been great to talk to you again, and please come back some more. I'd like to get some more updates on this as it progresses. Obviously, the sad news for Dying with Dignity, but perhaps we'll see a change with an election coming soon.
Well, it's not just the election, Ethan. Thanks for having me here. But, I think that, too, that when this became a topic of conversation this summer and it was a national conversation about my thesis and its findings and stuff, the charities started talking more to the media about this. And I'm really excited about it. And I'm not saying it's the charities I interviewed. It's different charities came forward and say, oh, we're going through this and this is our experience. And they're talking to each other and hopefully something will come of this, because though they were scared to talk to me, they're also they also understand that they have some power. They're not disempowered organizations, but they're worried.
Well, let's take a quick break here on The Sector, and we will return after this.
We all know that the word jazz means many different things to many different people, so check out The Real Deal on The Jazz Show at CITR 101.9 FM or CITR.ca for live streaming. Yours truly, Gavin Walker, is your host, and I guarantee the straight goods of 3 hours of jazz at its finest. So come on by and give your ears a musical workout, 9 p.m. Mondays. Don't miss it.
Beautiful country. I
I rode out here about 50 years ago on a little dun horse and started a film career. Picture called The Big Trail. Well, I made quite a few since then. Some good, some bad. Matter of fact, in those days...
CITR!
Matter of fact, they come in pretty handy anytime. It's kind of nice to know you have something set aside. So if you ever figure on that, remember that...
CITR!
Can be mighty helpful.
Yeah!
And we are back here on The Sector with me, Ethan Clow, on CITR. Well, our thanks to Gareth for joining us on the show. It's been a long time coming having him on, I think. It's been great to read his thesis, to see the effect it's been having on media, not just in sort of getting the word out there, but I think also kind of perhaps empowering charities a little bit more, making them feel a bit more powerful and a bit more potent. And, I mean, ultimately, this really ties into the question of not just political activity, how much should a charity be doing of political activity, but also, you know, what is the importance of political activity for a charity? We often get the assumption that a charity has to be neutral, that the cause is the most important thing. But as we're learning, advocating for the cause can be just as important. In fact, may even be more important in some cases. When we're talking about poverty or harm reduction or the environment, making sure that people understand and can get a good grasp on what it is you're trying to do as an organization, sometimes that's more important than simply making your mission happen, if you understand what I'm saying. So again, fantastic stuff from Gareth. We'll have him on the show again in the future. And like I said, tune in next week when we have Noah Ferguson on. We're going to dive more into this topic right now of how political do charities need to get. Well, we are almost out of time here on the show. Before we sign off, there was one more topic that I wanted to quickly mention, and this is to sort of prime the pump for future episodes, as well as to kind of reflect back on previous segments that we did a few weeks ago on The Sector. That is on the anti-vaccination movement, which, if you're following the news, you know, is not down and out. In fact, it's as dangerous as ever. Recent news stories have talked about the danger of a measles outbreak. This is as a result of low immunization rates and the increasing presence of the anti-vaccination movement in politics and policy across North America, here in Canada, as well as in the United States. Now, measles itself is a contagious, potentially dangerous disease, usually not too dangerous to people who have healthy immune systems. However, for those who have a compromised immune system, for a variety of reasons, are in danger of getting the measles. It could easily be fatal to them, and even for those who it's not fatal in, measles can have complications later in life. It's one of those viruses that sticks around in the body. Now, of course, the consequences of this are that people who have compromised immune systems, whether they're young or old, they could die from the measles, which is tremendously tragic because it's a preventable disease. Now, the way things normally work is that if enough of us get the vaccine, we create a system called herd immunity. And what this does is it prevents the virus from moving around a population. Because so many of us are immune, the virus has nowhere to go and spread. But if there are gaps in immunity caused by the anti-vax movement, then the virus has room to move around and spread. And perhaps it will infect somebody who's healthy, who didn't get the vaccine, and they may bite off the virus. They may have complications later in life, but they won't die. But they will spread the virus around in that time. And they may infect somebody who simply couldn't get the vaccine because of their compromised immune system. And that puts them at grave risk. Now, again, this is not simply an issue of science or public health. This is an issue of protecting our neighbors, of protecting the people around us, of making society safe for everybody. This isn't a question of simply science versus personal choice or a parent's right to not vaccinate their children. This is about safeguarding society,
This is about making sure that everybody who lives here in North America has the right to walk down the street and not be worried about becoming a biohazard. This is a very important social justice issue. The anti-vaccination movement, of course, has been making news, as I alluded to. There's been a number of incidents in the last few months that have been very troubling, I think, for proponents of vaccines and those of us who are against outbreaks of preventable diseases. For instance, there's been a series of outbreaks in California, around 67 last I checked. And in fact, what's disturbing about many of these outbreaks in California is that they seem to have originated in Disneyland parks. Now, why would that be significant? Well, Disneyland parks happen to be a congregation point for kids and families and such. So they go there, they're unvaccinated, some of them are probably carrying around measles inside of them, they spread it around, a bunch of people get infected, and increases the chance that somebody who's not immune, who, again, for lack of a vaccine or for immune deficiency reason, was unable to get the vaccine, now they're put at great risk. So again, you know, here's exactly the kind of thing that we have to worry about now, is outbreaks of measles in Disneyland. That's not good for tourism. The situation got so far that unvaccinated people were being warned to avoid Disneyland parks. Additionally, it came to light that an instructor at Queen's University in Ontario was actually teaching a course on the harm of vaccines. This teacher was brought under public attention recently when students complained, and the university itself is now doing an investigation into this teacher's conduct, which is, I think, fantastic news. I mean, it's a welcome change of pace than the old academic freedom defense, where we have a right to tell our students wrong information and turn them into walking biohazards. It's an excellent change of pace, but it does represent a huge issue. I mean, the fact that this person has been getting away with this for years, essentially, you know, enabling students to endanger themselves and the people around them. It's despicable. I mean, it's disgusting that how this could have gone on for so long. One final little note about the anti-vax movement and the recent news it's been generating. I actually saw a BuzzFeed article where they reached out to various candidates for the 2016 presidential election in America, asking them about their stance on vaccinations. So it was kind of interesting to read through that and just sort of see, you know, where everybody stands on it. I actually think that a few of the politicians who were asked have since actually revised their answer a little bit, and you can probably sort of follow the links on that one. But, you know, for instance, it's kind of interesting to look at here, you know, who said vaccines are safe and effective and who said they're dangerous and shouldn't be used, that kind of thing. I'll have the links on our show notes, of course, at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. Well, we are all out of time here on The Sector. Once again, my thanks to Gareth Kirkby for joining us on the show to discuss the nonprofit world and the CRA audits, as well as his thesis statement that kind of started the whole conversation. And of course, my thanks to you for tuning in, and hopefully you enjoyed today's show, and you will tune in next week when we have Noah Ferguson on. If you want to contact us here at The Sector, you can email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. Of course, we are also on Twitter at Ethan Clow, that's me, and at Sector Podcast. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/sectorpodcast, and you can find our show notes as well as the podcast at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. Well, thank you all. See you again next week.
Don't you know it's cool?